Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And well, it's that time of the year again. Well, everybody's getting itchy to go out of doors and do battle with the gorilla.
Yeah. Well, some places they gorilla it all year round, I guess. And the people we have in today's program certainly are dedicated to barbecue and do it all the year round, I feel sure. And starting out, perhaps an unusual entry.
Yeah, well, we can't actually put this in the barbecue category because that's one of the myths we want to dispel, is that there's a whole lot more to Korean cooking than barbecue.
But it's really funny. The Chef Dookie said that's all he really is. He's just a small little barbecue place in Koreatown in New York. Now the author of his book immediately contradicted that and said this is a restaurant where he had some of the finest meals in his whole life.
Yeah.
So certainly Koreatown is undoubtedly wherever there is one worth a visit, and Koreatown the book is certainly worth a visit and adding to your library. So here's Dookie, what's his last name?
Dookie Hong and Matt Rodbard.
Matt Rodbard wrote the book, and Dookie's the chef, and here they are.
Yep.
Well, this is an exciting segment for me. I have been listening to...
Cuffing up there, it might be a whole watch.
I have been listening to predictions and maybe it's prophecy that the next really hot trend will be Korean food. And so, as I was saying to Dookie Hong, who is a Korean chef, and Matt Rodbard, who is the writer for this book called Koreatown, I keep waiting for it all to come together and make sense for me. I mean, I remember interviewing the guys who discovered black garlic from Korea in the middle of the night, they were. And I have all these ingredients, but I don't actually use them, I don't think, the way they're supposed to be used. So you had some thoughts on that, Dookie. Tell me about it. First of all, why now? Do you think we're finally hitting this big revolution in the, what would you call it, of Korean food?
Absolutely. I mean, I think on kind of what we were going on is that we kept talking about it, Matt Rodbard and I, we just worked on this project a little over two years ago, and we kept saying, okay, and everyone has been telling us, all right, Korean food is hot, Korean food is going to be the next big thing,
yes,
but then it's going to go away after you kind of like how kale was and other food trends, but we've actually been having this conversation for the past 5 years. And,
yeah, well, I think so.
Yeah, and it hasn't been going away, and we really feel, Matt and I both feel, that it's not something that's going to go away next year or anything like that. It's just going to be a staple in our cuisine.
Well, there is a change. I mean, as I mentioned to you, up until fairly recently, all the Korean chefs and cooks I knew had sushi restaurants. What was that about?
I just feel like even for me, I graduated culinary school maybe about 7 years ago, and all my Korean friends coming out of school, we weren't going to do Korean food or going to Korean restaurants. You know, we were trying to go to prestigious Italian restaurants, French restaurants, and yes, even the Japanese restaurants. Just cause, I don't really know. It's not something that, I don't think Korean food hasn't been refined. No one even took the initiative to really bring it out to the mainstream. Just cause it was something that we cooked at home. So it was just home food for us, not something that we felt like we could bring it out to the public or sell it at a restaurant. Even at Book Koreatown, we kind of dive into the fact that, you know, Koreatown is more of a mentality than a physical place. And we've traveled, Matt and I traveled over two years for this. And we really felt like that kind of that for us by us mentality was huge. Koreans weren't out there to kind of make their cuisine known or be the next popular
thing.
And
it was my job as the writer on the project to work with Dookie and to get this kind of perspective from Koreatown. Because it really is the first time a book has been written from that point of view, telling stories from this culture that was so almost clandestine for years. And really, it was, to me as a journalist, it was just magical, like unlocking these secrets and realizing that there were these soups that Koreans were making for generations but really hadn't been focused on in a cookbook. So that's why soups and stews is our biggest chapter.
Yeah,
we really wanted to focus on these Western dishes.
Now,
Is there actually a place called Koreatown? He said a moment ago that there isn't, but is there, like, is there a section like Chinatown or like the parts of Queens that are taken up with other cuisines?
Well, in certain cities there are Koreatowns, like Chinatown, like in Los Angeles, for example. It's a very large part of the city. It's one of the largest ethnic groups to settle in Los Angeles, and it extends over 5 miles.
Okay,
so you're finding blocks and blocks and blocks of Korean restaurants. So yes, there are Koreatowns. But in smaller communities like Madison, Wisconsin, or, you know, Lincoln, Nebraska, there are smaller pockets, maybe a block or two, where there'll be a Korean grocery store next to a restaurant, next to a laundromat, and a church down the street where everyone goes on Sunday. And that's Koreatown, too. So there really isn't a uniform Koreatown.
I had another question before we go any further. And it's interesting. How much of it would you ascribe to the David Chang phenomenon? And we used to meet David in New York at the James Beard Awards, and we christened them the David Chang James Beard Memorial Awards because every year he would win for something else. Deserved or undeserved is a matter of argument, but he was always there. And he's in your book, and he says, I don't cook Korean. Explain that to me if you would.
So I've worked for Dave for probably 6 years ago, kind of before, I guess, like as you're mentioning, that before he was kind of the quote-unquote food god that he is now, and kind of the David Chang that he is now. But I mean, no one can deny his impact in the food industry. I respect him. Matt and I both respect what he's done, and he's adamant about the fact that he's not. It's more of not Korean cuisine. Or if you told him, do I cook Japanese cuisine? Does he cook Japanese cuisine? He'll emphatically say no. Also, he just doesn't want to be defined or put in a box of any cuisine, whether that's, you know, he calls it, if he had to name it, he'll name it American, because that's like probably the most vague thing you can call anything. But, you know, he just wants to do momofuku food, and, you know, so even when I was working for him, it was just kind of branded into us that we're not doing X type of food. We're using Korean ingredients, we're using Japanese ingredients, but just because we're using those ingredients doesn't mean we're cooking that food,
right,
which is kind of something to wrap your head around and really just do the food. All he wants to do is just tasty, delicious food, period.
And I mean,
so,
I'm sure,
he's Korean, and he grew up eating the food, but...
And I'm sure I'm not using all these ingredients. I have these Korean ingredients properly, but it's tasty. I mean, I'm terrible. I sometimes just spoon it out of the jar or some of this stuff.
No, and we say it, Matt and I say it, like we, you know, we have a beautiful pantry section in our book, and Matt really detailed it out where it's very friendly, it's not boring, it's not just a list of things that you don't
right.
understand. He really translated it to kind of, if we were talking to our friends and we had to explain what gochujang was or doenjang was.
That's one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm. And I love it, I would love to see how you use it. You know, Matt and I always go back about how I'm always kind of stuck in my ways, as a Korean, as a chef. I only know how to use doenjang in the way that it's traditionally used. It'd be weird for me to use it in X way, you know, as a marinade, as a barbecue rub or some weird stuff, as a salad dressing. But we've gotten a lot of the people that bought our books sending us stuff like, oh, I tried it on this and that.
Uh-huh.
And like, for us, that's so interesting.
Yeah, that must be fun for you. Tell me the name of your restaurant.
So our restaurant is, we have a restaurant in Koreatown, New York City, called Paekjeong. It means the butcher. It's in the heart of Koreatown, fittingly. So we're just a Korean barbecue joint, just trying to do some simple, nothing crazy, good quality meats, fun atmosphere, Korean barbecue.
As a slightly biased observer, but less biased than Dookie, it is probably the best Korean restaurant in New York. Just because
he's not biased though, by any means.
Yeah, no, I'm not biased. But really, I credit Dookie for kind of ushering this revolution in New York where Korean barbecue is not using commodity meats. I mean, he's using some of the best meats in all the city. Like, it's steakhouse quality. But it's done in this relaxed environment, and it's kind of phenomenal to have this incredibly refined and polished meal, but have it in such a convivial environment. I love going there. I was just there on Friday night, and I don't ever get sick of it. And that's really just Korean food in general. We've had hundreds of meals together, Dookie and I, and I've never felt bored or exhausted from it. It's pretty remarkable.
It's interesting. There's a restaurant which was established, I guess, as a Japanese restaurant here in Pittsburgh called Sushi Kim, And the owner is Mr. Kim. Mr. Kim is from Korea via Baltimore, I think, or something like that. Mm. And he started out as a tiny space, then he got wider, then he got a second floor, and finally he realized his dream, which was to put a Korean barbecue set up on the second floor, devoted to the very kinds of things that you were saying you experience. There's a beef dish that starts with a B, I think.
A bulgogi.
Bulgogi, that's it.
Bulgogi.
Yeah, and so he's got exactly the same kind of arrangement that you're used to, and interestingly, I don't think it did very well. I don't think it was a dream for him to have it installed, but people here don't understand it. Now, in New York, you've got a much more sophisticated, a much more widely dined around experience, so you're prepared for the kinds of things that Dookie can do.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting, because the concept of Korean barbecue is just meat and fire cooked in front of you, and it's a very simple thing, but I think, you know, anytime you're messing with kind of the familiar, what people are used to or familiar dining experiences, you're always going to have a little bit of pushback, whatever it is, whether it's really good, really bad. Indian food, eating it with your hands, I mean, it's just tradition, but people are very freaked out by, like, oh, who eats it with their hands? I don't know, there's 2 billion people in India that eat it with their hands. So it's kind of like anything small or big like that, that's kind of, when you're kind of tweaking the usual familiar dining experiences, I think people are always going to have, and you know, for us in our book, we just kind of encourage people to dive in. You're like, yes, it's a little weird. It's a little funky. It's not your usual, ketchup and mustard. But it's good. Just trust us. And if you take that one little step, you'll definitely enjoy it.
Now this book, Koreatown, seems like an awfully good place to start understanding, if you're interested in doing your homework before you explore Korean dining, this would be an awfully good place to start, because you've got some really intriguing things, not just recipes, but opinions from different people, including, of course, David himself. You've got recipes of other chefs from around the country, some absolutely top chefs who cook Korean things in collaboration, presumably with you guys, to be able to put them in the book.
We wanted that section to be special. You know, we call it respect, really, because we're working with chefs who respect the product and respect Korean food traditions. Like we sought out a number of chefs in the beginning, and ultimately we picked only a few because they really did go above and beyond the quote-unquote kimchi taco or the, you know, the lasagna inspired by Korean, by gochujang, like the really basic stuff. Like these guys, like Stuart Brioza in San Francisco, does his own house-made kimchi with yuba and soft-boiled egg, which is just an unbelievable kind of riff with Korean flavors. You've got, like, Danny Bowen doing a bone broth called sulantang, but he does his with smoked brisket and uni. It's just kind of taking his intellectual curiosity and riffing on East versus West, but he does it in such a cool way. It really is that respect for the ingredients. So we have about 12 of those recipes, and we're really proud of them.
The interesting thing is...
And also, to Matt's credit, too, I mean, the way the book is written, we really focused on not making it 101 recipes, and like, you know, Matt mentioned the respect section, which is a nice little cutaway from the usual, oh, Dookie's recipes, or Korean recipes made simple. But, you know, there's a lot of awesome stories, like you mentioned. Yes, we have an interview with Chef David Chang and his perspective.
Right.
We have people that aren't even in the food world, Patrick Stump and an author that even Johan, who's on the music industry, and we realized Korean food has impacted a lot of people in all different walks of life, not only in the food industry. And Matt really writes in a way that, like, if your friend was calling you and just telling you a cool story, so.
Well, he's funny. I mean, there's so much wit to it. I like the titles of these little sections, like How to Cook Korean Food at Home Without Pissing Off Your Neighbors. I love that.
I'm glad you like that. Thank you, Dookie, for the compliment. That's really nice of you, man.
Well, I like the way you do the unexpurgated David Chang.
yeah, absolutely. You can't filter that guy out.
For those of
it would be a crime against David Chang to censor that man, because you get him talking, and I just read a book of him talking. That's all I really need to do. I mean, he's unfiltered always.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But yeah, Dookie brought up a really good point. The food is essential, but the voice is really trying to talk to our friends, and we think Korean food is in a great place, and everyone's ready to tackle it, but they just needed a little bit of a jump start, and we think the voice and the writing really does that.
How about Eric Repair? I mean, that was a shock. I'm surprised.
It was a shock to all of us.
Yeah, it was very surprising. So I actually went to Korea with Eric in 2012. What's that?
What fun that would be.
It was fun. Yeah, Eric is a very passionate Buddhist. He practices daily, and he and I kind of came together. We were friends before the trip, but I really wanted to take him there and experience Korean cuisine at the root, but also Buddhist cuisine in the temples outside Seoul. And we got to experience that firsthand. I wrote a story for Bon Appetit, kind of profiling that. But then I think Eric's been back twice since, and he is absolutely enamored with Buddhist temple cuisine. And you're seeing style of cooking being represented in New York Times. And New York Times Magazine did a story, and it's going to be on the next season of Chef's Table, which is a great show on Netflix that is a documentary series.
Now, let's do something goofy here. Say something that's a myth, a misconception of Korean food that should be corrected and then corrected.
Ooh. Jokey, you want to start? Okay, I'll take a crack at that. So what we're doing is we're saying a myth and disputing it. Okay, I'll say the first one, which is Korean food is barbecue-centric. An absolute myth. If you go to Korea or if you go to these traditional restaurants in the United States, you're going to find seafood is so prevalent. This goes back to Korea's geography. Korea is a peninsula, and there's 1,500 miles of coastline in Korea, and seafood is essential to the diet. So seaweeds, anchovy broth is in many of the soups. You've got shrimp, mackerel, and squid sautéed. Often you've got dried filefish being served as kind of like a fish jerky at the pochas. So while barbecue is important in the States and it's very delicious, in Korea, barbecue is more of a luxury, and seafood is more of a common workaday cuisine.
Absolutely. I mean, Matty nailed it with, and we're really trying to go beyond barbecue, we feel like Korean food has a lot more layers than that. But, and also another myth I would say about Korean food or cooking is that fast, that it's pretty, cause Koreatown is kind of synonymous, like, kind of that fast paced, food ready in minutes. But, being in the kitchen and really cooking Korean food and really diving into the cuisine, you realize how slow it is and how much time is an ingredient. In the restaurant, all of my sauces, even simple salad dressings, because the addition of fresh fruits, vegetables, garlic, onions, and these are all incorporated into the actual sauces and marinades, you can't use it right away. So all my sauces sit for minimum 1 day just to mellow out and really settle in. It's not like making a nice little ranch dressing and you put it right away. If I wanted to make a salad for you, I would need a day to prepare. Even just talking about kimchi, which is the national staple dish, that ferments from minimum 2 weeks to 2 months to 2 years. So you just realize that's one small plate in your banchan, which is 6 to 8 banchans you may get, and you don't realize that took about minimum 3 months for it to get to your table. So Korean food, it being centered around fermentation, and fermentation really being about developing awesome flavors and layers of flavors, but it does take time to do that. So that's one myth that people, I feel like they have, because they've kind of put it in the same category as Chinese food or kind of like those fast Thai food.
Everybody I know is making kimchi.
Right, but you can't, although in our book, we do have a quick kimchi recipe, because we're like, all right, this is America, people want to think fast. If you wanted a quick kimchi, we really do have some awesome recipes in there. And that's just kind of Matt and I just playing around, but they're delicious. But in that same respect, in that same chapter, if you wanted to really ferment something for a few months to a year, we have a recipe for that too.
And you have a lot of visiting guests. Chefs like Jamie Bissonette giving you recipes, and I think you actually add more creative, not traditional things yourselves, right? Recipes.
Yeah, I think one example is the Korean fried fish. I think we've shared whole fish in both Korean restaurants, Chinese restaurants. We just both love whole fish. It's like, who doesn't love a fried whole fish? And Juki's recipe is really innovative, in that it takes a kimchi salt that he created that is the essence of kimchi made into a powder form, and he sprinkles that on top of a whole fried fish,
And you invented that, did you, Dookie? Did
you? I'm gonna patent it, so hopefully I can retire on that.
Well, yeah, I'd like some of that. That would be good.
So yeah, we just call it, Matt and I just call it like a Korean obey seasoning. Really delicious. It's just cool because it just really smells and tastes like kimchi, but it's in a dry form. So anything you can do with a rub or obey in general, you could do with the salt. So that's something that we're really proud of. Yeah, I think definitely Maddie mentioned the respect chapter and chefs that are participated in that book, like Jamie Bissonette, like you said, Chef Eric Repair, 3-star chef, cool chefs like Danny Bowen, really do pushing the envelope. And you realize all these chefs, you know, for me it's great because these guys are like my heroes. And they're all in one book, and they all share the love of Korean food. So, it's such an incredible project.
I think this book is really wonderful. And, I mean, it opens your vista to so many things that you dream that maybe all these things were out there, but you really didn't know. And this book points you into these directions that you can find new excitement. There's so much to learn that we don't know about Korean food. And I think you just did a wonderful job in presenting it. Dookie
and
Matt.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, well, much success with this book. And maybe I can now use some of my ingredients that I don't know what to do with.
There you go.
But the kimchi salt is great. I hope you are patenting that kimchi salt. That's pretty cool. Yeah. The other whole thing is at some point that I think people should learn to use seaweed the way the Koreans do, but that's a whole other book.
Yeah, absolutely. So we could do a whole chapter on seaweed. I mean, if you go to Busan, they've got many different types of seaweed that you're going to find drying on the shore, and it's a really great tradition there. But yeah, book two, for sure.
Well, thank you both, and hopefully we'll meet in person.
We'd love to see you in Koreatown in New York.
We will. Dookie and Matt, thank you so much. The book is Koreatown. Just like that, and it's a nice cover, too.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.com. .net.
Welcome back. Something that seems to be on everybody's mind today, whether it be the upcoming Olympics or the Zika virus, is Brazil. I mean, that's quite a stretch, but at any rate.
I don't know we needed the Zika virus.
Well, anyhow. But Brazil is having its moment in the sun for sure. And our next guest knows what he's talking about, Evandro Carignato. His book is Churrasco, Grilling the Brazilian Way. And I think that it's a distinction we hadn't really thought about until we got this wonderful book.
Well, see, it's funny because as Americans, of course, we think we invented barbecue, and then the Spanish colonials, I guess, sneak in there somewhere. And then there's this Churrasco thing, which...
Churrasco.
Churrasco.
He says it so beautifully, too.
And there's a version of it, curious enough, that comes out of Argentina, which most people associate with Latin American barbecue, which is you get great big fat steaks, you cover them with a very liberal amount of salt, you throw them on a grate, and that's what you do. And that's the way the Brazilians do it, that's the way the Uruguayans do it too. The Brazilians, even though the gauchos of southern Brazil and Uruguay and Argentina probably don't even know which country they're in a lot of the time, and they don't distinguish themselves.
True.
They're just gauchos.
Gaucho cuisine is what it is.
But that manifestation in Brazil is, if you like, in the Brazilian restaurants called Churrascos, there is a difference.
Churrascos.
So you'll quickly find out that there are similarities and then there are differences, and those differences will help you if you're investigating Argentine restaurants. I mean, Brazilian restaurants in the United States and Brazilian restaurants in Brazil if you go there. So pay attention if you're planning on that.
Well, if you happen to see a small restaurant with lines out the door, it may very well be a churrasco restaurant, a Brazilian grill, and the culinary director of one of such of these groups of restaurants, Texas de Brazil, is Evandro Carignato, and he wrote this book called, simply, Churrasco. He's going to talk to us about, first of all, this is your native cuisine. It's gaucho fare. Tell us, where are you from? Where is it native to?
Hello. Well, thanks so much for having me. Yes, the gauchos are the people from South Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay, in a specific region, geographical region called Pampas. There is a lot of grassland, a lot of cattle, and with all that cows, no surprise, they love beef so much. Yes. And the gauchos from Brazil, they were the ones created this concept many, many years ago, over 100 years ago, called churrasco.
Do that pronunciation again. That's amazing.
Yeah. Churrasco.
There we go.
Churrasco.
I certainly wouldn't have said it like that. I'm glad we had you.
It's a very strong word. It's a very macho word, churrasco.
Oh, it is beautiful.
It's almost like cursing someone.
So anyhow, how would you define this cuisine?
The concept is very simple. One thing, like for to understand, in this kind of restaurant called churrascarias, that's a Brazilian, it's a steakhouse. Churrascaria is the name of a steakhouse in Brazil, for the steakhouse in Brazil. The difference is that you don't have a menu. You don't place an order. You're gonna be offered every single meat that's been cooked. Usually, it's about most of the churrascarias, they have anything between 10 to 20 different kinds of meat, from pork, sausage, chicken, beef, and lamb. We call rodizio, it's an endless service. You're going to get all the meats from the grill. We have the gauchos, they are the meat servers. They cook meat over an open flame, and they bring right to your table and this carved table side.
In so front you don't of place a sword or a skewer, right?
Yes, skewers. They're about like 35, 40 inches long skewers, you know, and they bring that to your table. So you don't need to place an order. You don't have to worry about if you're going to be eating lamb or chicken or pork or beef or tenderloin or lamb chops that night. All the meats, they're going to be brought to you. Beside that, very, very important, we have what we call the salad area. It's a gourmet salad bar station. You're going to, at least with Tex Brazil, you're going to find very, very many nice and gourmet items, from lobster bisque. We have salty mushrooms. There is a very nice selection of cheeses from Italy, Spain, to complement the meal. And we also have, it's a lot of food. You have no idea how much food. You cannot live hungry. You know, we also bring side dishes to your table. You know, we have fried bananas, garlic mashed potatoes, cheese bread, and just for one simple single price. You don't pay for the items you eat.
Wow.
Now let's go back to basics, though. The gauchos were essentially cowboys. I mean, we would call them cowboys, and they herded their beef across the pampas, regardless, I'm sure, of what the national boundaries were. They probably didn't even know where they were.
At that time, there was no one, yes.
And they developed this style of cooking always on a skewer, because it made it so much easier to handle the food,
I'm guessing. Exactly. Yes.
So just like we make kebabs in other cuisines around the world, it's the same idea. And what you've done with Texas de Brazil is to really make that into sort of like a machine for feeding lots and lots of people instead of just the cowboys feeding themselves.
Exactly. There was evolution, you know, like the very first gauchos, the way they're cooking meats, they would use like some spare long branches of wood, and they would skewer the meat, and they would cook on the outside, you know, where they're moving cattle from one region to another region to sell. So they would stop during the night, they would cook these huge skewers of meat, this low cooking, you know, low temperature, and roasted meat. And from there, you know, like the farms, the ranches went back in their families. They kept cooking that way with more varieties of meat, more skewers, until eventually that became a form, like a concept, like restaurants start serving that kind of meat. Like in Brazil, if you go to Brazil, going to be very, very hard. At least when I was growing up, it was almost impossible to find a place, a steakhouse, that you could go there and order a single piece of meat. They would understand why would you order a ribeye or a filet mignon if you can go to another place that you'll be serving everything, you know, and usually for the same price as a single piece in a steakhouse. So steakhouses, as we have in the United States and many parts of the world, was not something common, was very, very hard to find in Brazil many years ago.
So if you're headed for the Olympics, remember to diet for a long time before you go.
Yes, you are correct.
Because you're going to pack up the pans while you're there, I guess.
Yes.
Well, now, the book, I want to point out, gives a lot of history and background and explanation of this cuisine and its origins. But in addition to that, you have really interesting recipes in here. I'm looking at pork ribs with yucca flour, and also...
Oh, yes, I'm very familiar with that. I love that one.
Yeah, well, you said that is in your family, and you say it's unique.
Yeah, that is not something you're going to see very, very often. That's a very, very unique, very... I don't think many people are going to be familiar with the yucca, the cassava flour. Now, a bad way to explain that is almost like it looks like, it feels like sand or the dust, you know, wood dust. But actually, you know, is a very tasty and crispy flour made with cassava or yucca that was toasted. And when you coat the pork ribs, as we show in the recipe, as you cook, it absorbs all the fat. It gives like a wonderful, wonderful texture. It's really, really interesting.
And then another interesting one and another family one is the picanha with horseradish and garlic.
Yes, that's another great, great one.
You say whenever you get homesick, you eat that.
Yeah, I'm looking at that one right now. Yeah, that is really, really awesome. It's a very good way to do this cut. Many people are not even very familiar. Most of the people actually they never heard about this, the picanha. That's the culotte. It comes from the top sirloin,
right.
Most tender part of the top sirloin. And one very interesting thing about the picanha, that in Brazil, it costs more, much more actually, than the tenderloin, because everybody loves it so much. Like it doesn't compete. The tenderloin is not, you know, usually you're gonna be first. They're gonna sell out all the picanhas before they start selling any tenderloin or any other cuts.
I saw something interesting that existed in two different areas of the book. One you just described, which is a cut of beef, but you somehow arrange the cut of beef so that the fatty part's on the outside, protecting the meat inside to make sure the meat inside doesn't get all dried out.
Exactly.
But then you do something rather similar to that with chicken thighs, with skin on chicken thighs.
Oh, always, yeah. That's another thing.
So again, you wrap the skin around so that the meat is all covered up.
Yes, that's one of my favorite cuts of chicken. It is my favorite cut of chicken, the chicken thighs. But it has, in my opinion, you need to have the skin. Otherwise, it's going to be a little bit too dry. And it's so tasty and crispy. It's a great, great way to do the chicken thighs.
It's interesting. I made chicken soup for Anne today because hasn't been feeling well, and she said she wanted chicken soup, so I made some. But I took the skins off the chicken thighs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to fry those tomorrow for my lunch.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That would be great.
Now, we should point out that some of these marinades and sauces are very important to the overall dish. of these grilled meats. And one of the most recognizable and thought about and talked about, you have a huge recipe in here for chimichurri sauce. What exactly is it?
Well, the chimichurri is actually, I say that in the book, it's not Brazilian. It's something from Argentina. The Argentina, you know, create that kind of sauce,
right.
But it goes so well, you know, and with the meat that we start serving that a couple of years ago, and people go crazy. They really love it, and it's pretty simple to do. I tried, you know, in the beginning, because in the beginning tried to recreate. I went to Buenos Aires once, and I had a great steak with the chimichurri. I said, no, we're going to start serving the chimichurri at Texas de Brazil. And I tried to duplicate that, but I was having some issues because I was trying to make it faster, you know, in a larger volume. I was using a food processor. And that doesn't work because now you're going to have like a bland, sauce. And it's not, it has to be a little chunky. So it's pretty simple. All you need is parsley, cilantro, but much less cilantro. More is parsley. So parsley, cilantro, garlic. You can use as much garlic as you want. Some dry oregano, red crushed, pepper, olive oil, and lemon juice or vinegar. So you just mix those ingredients the way you want, but it's like a chunky green salsa, and it tastes better. Next day, the flavors, they're going to blend, and tastes always better the next day.
Now, you don't cook that. You just serve it on the side?
No, it's raw. Everything, just chop everything fresh and mix with the oil and the vinegar.
And then you serve that beside a steak or a lamb chop or whatever you feel like.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
you can save. If my steak is a little bit too dry, that can save your day.
So you actually you start with basics and traditional foods, but you amplify them and do riffs on them, right?
Yes. And everything, you know, like in that book, I want to do something that was representing my hometown. You know, like the place I came from, the birthplace of churrasco. If I was going to do a book about Brazilian cuisine, it would be very diluted. It would be a little bit from every region of the country. It's a huge country, Brazil, many different cultures. So I want to stay with something that was very true to my roots.
You have a lot of Italian influences, but Italians immigrated to Brazil in large numbers, right?
Exactly, about 1850, 1875, and it's very interesting. We speak about that in the book. The Gauchos, they're being there in that part of the country, in the Pampas, in South America for many years. But around 1800, the Italians and Germans, they migrated to Brazil, and there, before the Gauchos would eat only beef. That's it. You know, and with the Germans and Italians, they brought lamb, they brought pork, they brought sausage, and they kind of had they got together, start cooking together with all different cuts of meat.
Yeah, well,
so Italians and Germans, they have a very strong influence in the South.
Yeah, parmesan crusted pork loin. I've never even had that, and I'm Italian. You have sides, you have all kinds of interesting things. Your black bean stew looks really good. Now that's
we're proud. We have a lot of very, very nice recipes. Some of them are going to be a little bit more difficult to execute. You know, we have like instructions how to build a grill. Using like very simple materials, you know, cost almost nothing, but works so, so well. You have no idea, you know, how tasty it can be when you, the meat, when you cook using that, grill that we show there, how to make it.
Well, now, I mean, how typical is this? Or is this one of your creations? The cream of jalapeno soup.
Oh, that is something is not Brazilian at all. That is one of the recipes because we have a bunch of recipes. They are Texas de Brazil. You know, like things that we do at Texas de Brazil. This I learned once I went to, we have a place, Fort Worth in Texas.
Yeah, sure,
one day
sure.
I went there, I was visiting the kitchen, and the employees in the kitchen, the chef and the cooks, they are eating this soup. I said, well, what's that? And they offered me some, a bowl, was so, so good. that we decided to start serving that for lunch every day, and people really like it. It's kind of weird to say that, but actually the guys in the kitchen, the chef and the prep, they're eating better than the guests. That was such a great soup, and that we decided to make it a lunch soup. So all of our locations, we serve that cream of jalapeno for lunch and lobster bisque for dinner.
Well, now, you mentioned all your locations. Do you have these locations on your website? People could go to the website?
Oh, yes. If you go texasthebrazil.com, you're going to find every single information about Texas Brazil locations, hours of operation, menu, everything.
Right, and then everybody should buy this cookbook. You'd say it again,
Churrasco.
Churrasco. Yes.
And yeah, it's Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's selling very well.
Right. People should be doing it at home now.
Yeah.
Well, Evandro, it's been great talking to you.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
And I think that your recipes are very interesting.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Having dealt with the Korean and the Brazilian tradition of barbecue, it's only fair to cover the barbecue of our nation's heartland, of our nation's southern region in particular, where barbecue is the greatest thing since
barbecue,
since sliced bread, whatever you like to call it. And there's a great series called Savor the South, which we've been following for the last 3 or 4 years, I guess. And we were not surprised to find out that one of the series most recently published was a Savor the South cookbook devoted specifically to barbecue. And
you know, when I read the introduction, I found myself laughing out loud. So I knew that John Shelton Reed was going to be a really wonderful, remarkable guest. Witty, funny. And didn't take himself too seriously, but gives you a good perspective on barbecue southern ways.
The main thing, the most interesting thing we found out about is that John Reed was a professor and a don in residence at Peter's Old College at the University of Cambridge, although they were not exactly there at the same time. Just shows you a lot of coincidences, but there's a lot of humor and a lot of fascinating history of barbecue in this beautiful little book. We were having so much fun talking to John Shelton Reed about student times at the University of Cambridge, where it turns out I attended as an undergraduate and he attended as a teacher. A fellow, no less. My goodness, a don of all things. But that's not what we're talking about today. Today we're talking about a good old American tradition called barbecue. Now, let's start off with first principles. We know that barbecue comes from, I think it's a Spanish word.
Barbacoa.
The barbacoa. But what's the legend as to how barbecue caught on in the southern states of the United States?
Well, Peter, every society, darn near every society has some tradition of slow cooking tough meat. I mean, and that's a good way to cook it for a long time at a low temperature, and it makes it easier to eat. So, I mean, the British had a hog roast tradition before they came to North America. There's a sort of melding that goes on here. The word barbecue does, as you say, come from barbacoa, and that's how the Spanish heard a West Indian word that referred to a frame on which they cooked the meat. It was a wooden frame, so naturally they had to cook it at a low temperature. The frame would burn.
That's funny. I never thought about that.
There are drawings of Indians cooking various things on these frames. Usually it's fish and reptiles of various kinds and birds. They didn't have hogs till the Spanish showed up, but very quickly they figured out that that's a very good thing to cook. And by the 1500s, you have Spanish missionaries reporting that the natives are cooking hogs on these barbacoas and incidentally dousing them with lime juice and peppers.
Which comes
very much like, Eastern North Carolina barbecue sauce today.
That's the truth, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, the word made its way to the North American mainland where it became attached to these big community hog roasts. And George Washington reported going to them in the 1760s. The community barbecue became a feature of the whole, all of the colonies, but especially, it turns out, colonies from the Chesapeake region of Maryland, Virginia, south. They reported barbecues in New England, but they gave it up. Plant bakes instead. But yeah. Anyhow, that's how it got there. Barbecue as we know it in North Carolina really had to wait till the early 19th century when somebody brought this citrus and pepper version from the Caribbean, probably either refugees from the Haitian Revolution or slaves who were imported from the West Indies. And by the middle of the 19th century, you had people cooking all kinds of animals, not just hogs, mutton, and sides of beef, cooking with this sauce, which is, as I say, still found today in eastern North Carolina. Other people have moved on.
Yeah, I mean, Texas is totally there. Everyone has its own tradition, right?
Well, they do now. As recently as the late 19th century, the 1880s, so everybody was cooking pretty much what you now find in eastern North Carolina and a few outposts elsewhere, the whole hogs with a, they started using vinegar instead of lime juice.
Yeah.
A little easier to get hold of vinegar. Vinegar and red pepper and salt and not much else really. That's the basics. And you use it not as a sauce, but as a mop while it's cooking and then sprinkle a little on to be a seasoning. But people hear barbecue sauce and they think of this stuff that like ketchup with stuff in it. It's basically what that's the Kansas City style. And it's also what they use in Mountain and the Deep South. But in the Carolinas, it's still a thin vinegar-based sauce.
And did you make up these names of things or are they traditional names? Like, righteous ribs.
I made up most of them.
Oh, okay. Because, I mean, we lived in Kansas City, and we ate burnt ends.
We should, by the way, note that the reason that we're talking to John is that he really is an expert, and he just produced a book in the Sale of the South series. Prove that. But
thank you for mentioning that. Yes.
Yes, that's why we're talking to him. The book is called Barbecue, not surprisingly.
But he has it injected with just... it's so much fun to read. I don't care if I ever cook anything that's in here.
Well, you know, I wrote it that way, if I may say so. I tried to make it a reading book, maybe even more than a cooking book, because there are so many barbecue cookbooks out there, the world really doesn't need another one. But it's in this Save of the South series from the University of North Carolina Press.
Which we like a lot, by the way.
Well, it's a great series. I'm proud to be part of it. There's a buttermilk cookbook and a cornbread cookbook.
And yeah, we've done okra. We've done,
we just got one called Greens.
Yeah.
See, there you go. And this series had to have a, Save of the South, it had to have one on barbecue. So what I tried to do was, rather than produce a book with innovative barbecue recipes or imaginative ones or even the best ones I know, I tried to do a book with absolutely typical Kansas City sauce, absolutely typical Texas rub, absolutely typical Eastern North Carolina sauce, and compare the different traditions and talk about how they evolved, one turned into another, and so forth. So it's as much history as it is cookbook, I think.
No, the last time we talked to someone about barbecue, and it was not too long ago, they had a recipe for Brunswick stew, and I said, you left out the number of squirrels in the, in the recipe. So I did get them to admit that if they had squirrels, they would probably use about five.
Well, I have an absolutely appalling Brunswick stew recipe in there.
I have to say,
it's made entirely from cans
We read that.
I actually put that in so I'd have something to take out when the press wanted me to take out something else. I could say, well, I'll take out the London Stew recipe, but, you know, I'm going to keep this other. But they didn't ask me to take it out. They're still there. But the point of that is it tells you what goes into a Brunswick stew, and you don't have to use canned corn, you know. You can use fresh corn if you want. And
it's like
fact,
my sister-in-law's shepherd's pie. Whenever she opens the cupboard, it finds in a can goes into shepherd's pie.
You can actually buy Brunswick stew canned in our part of the country, but it's not very good.
I'm sure you probably can.
Yeah, here you've got the Lord's Own Alabama rib sauce. Now, you made that up?
Well, no, there's a story there. There's a legendary rib joint in Tuscaloosa, Alabama called Dreamland.
Right.
And the African-American gentleman who founded it, he died some time ago, but the place is still there. He said the Lord came to him in a dream and gave him this sauce recipe.
Of course he did.
It's a secret, obviously, and unless the Lord chooses to share it with you, you have to sort of guess what's in it. But my friends Jim Ockwood and Susan Puckett reverse engineered this sauce, I think, pretty successfully, so I used their recipe.
Now, did you ever meet Stubbs? I think he was in Austin, Texas.
Oh no, I didn't. I've seen his products.
Yeah, we love his products.
We met his grandson.
Yeah, his products are absolutely terrific.
I got acquainted with Texas barbecue fairly late in the game because I now have a daughter who lives in Austin and a son-in-law who grew up in Austin. He's taken it on himself to educate me, so I think I know it pretty well now. But it's a recent. A recent acquisition.
I see.
Well, apparently some businessmen in Austin who were devotees of Stubbs' establishment, when he went bankrupt, they decided they would buy the business and set him up in it again.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did that until he died, and now I think the restaurant is still open, but they're doing absolute gangbuster business with their sauces and mops and injections.
There are places that are much better known for their sauces than their barbecue.
Yeah.
There's one in eastern North Carolina called, it's one of the older places in eastern North Carolina, and they switched, they're not cooking barbecue by my definition anymore. They're cooking slow-roasted pork with gas. There's no wood involved at all. But they have the sauce that they started with, and it's really good. They bottle it, sell it.
Yeah, now you have a pretty strict. A long discussion of what you view as real barbecue.
Yes. Well, let me say that I am co-founder of something called the Campaign for Real Barbecue.
Uh-huh.
And if you go to our website, which is trueque.org, that's TRUECUE.org, you'll see that we're zealots, fundamentalists about wood cooking. I have become somewhat, you know, if you want to grill salmon on a plank and call it barbecuing it, it's okay with me, you know.
And hot dogs, you said, that doesn't qualify.
Even if you want to, you know, cook hot dogs in your backyard with a gas cooker and say you're barbecuing, I'm not going to argue with you. But what this book is about is Southern barbecue, which is meat cooked for a long time at a low temperature with heat and smoke from wood and wood coals.
Give me that website again, John.
That's trueque.org, TRUECUE.org.
No, I was astounded because we were prepared to go to Austin several times, and there's a place there where the line starts to form at 8:30 in the morning called Franklin's.
Franklin, there in Franklin's Barbecue. Yes, this is an amazing phenomenon, and there's another one called La Barbecue, LA Barbecue, which has the same thing going. There's a real craft barbecue renaissance going on in Austin.
Well, I mean, have you had the stuff?
But here's the thing that astounded me, and the reason that we actually met the owner, is that his restaurant won Best Restaurant Southwest in the James Beard Awards in Chicago, and I saw him, and I thought, he's a kind of a young fellow to be owning a barbecue joint that's been around forever and ever and ever. So I asked him, he's only been open like 6 years.
No, he has a wonderful cookbook, by the way. You might want to
get
him on your show.
He was so popular, we couldn't even lay hands on it. And every time they wanted it, they were out of it and waiting for the next printing to come in.
Right. Well, I have it. It's a wonderful cookbook. He's a real student of the subject. You know, he tell you what to do and why to do it that way. So
you think it's worth it, the Franklin Barbecue?
Well, I'm not willing to stand in line that long. So
I wouldn't either.
Exactly.
My son-in-law has had it and says it's really remarkably good. I went to the other one, Law Barbecue, before it became a cult in its own right. It wasn't a long line. But Austin, interesting things going on there. And to be fair, interesting things are going on here in North Carolina as well. I may not have said that I'm in North Carolina. Anyway, we have sort of gentrification going on barbecue. We have places that are opening with really good wood-cooked whole hog barbecue, but the sides are prepared by chefs, you know. And the hogs are locally sourced, free-range, or grass-fed, that's all right. But free-range pasture-raised is the word I'm looking for. Pasture-raised hogs, and to tell you the name of the farmer and sometimes the name of the hog. And you're paying $10 for a barbecue sandwich that'll used to cost $3.50. It's really good.
Yeah, we go
and
to
they have wine lists and valet parking.
We cover the Nashville Food and Wine Festival every year. Well, 2 years in a row now.
It's called Music City Food
Music
and Wine.
Music City Food and Wine. And who is the pit master that, I mean, he has like, I don't know how many pits going at once. It's a major operation. And that's where everybody ends up. He does land.
North Carolina? Somebody from North Carolina?
No, he's local to Nashville. I think he's
local to Nashville.
I think he's local to Nashville. But he has friends from all over, and everybody gathers around.
They pitch in.
Well, you know, it's funny. For some reason, there's a real, you know, barbecue, somebody said maybe this year's cupcake. There's a real wave of new places opening and people writing about it.
It's been going on for a while. I mean, we went to the New York, what's that called? The
Big Apple Block
Party.
The Big Apple Block Party. I mean, that really is something. To not wait in line, and you still wait in line, was it $150? For a VIP ticket.
Oh, to go to the head of the line.
Yeah, we didn't do that, but we still.
You have a ticket, and you don't have to worry about having to buy a ticket at each particular place you go.
Well, Peter, eat your heart out. I'll tell you how we went. My wife and I wrote a book some years ago about North Carolina barbecue specifically, and we went up there to plug the book, and so we were. They gave us a tent to talk in. And we had little badges that said talent. And we just went to the head of the line.
We had badges that said media.
I'm not going back unless I can be talent again. 125,000 people are you?
It's enormous.
We finished up in the tent of a barbecue outfit from Yazoo City.
I can't remember their name.
I can't remember their name either.
Yeah. No, I think they were there the year we were there as well.
Yeah, these people are all show up at all these places, I guess.
Yeah. You probably ran into Ed Mitchell, who's a big guy and overalls, big black guy with a beard and overalls and cooking whole hogs. Ed's a showman. He's a North Carolinian. And a really good whole hog cooker.
Oh, there's so many. I mean, they're amazing.
Well, there is kind of a trail, isn't there? There is a series of...
A circuit, yeah.
A circuit. Because one of the stops they make is in Greenwood, South Carolina, where our son and daughter-in-law used to live. And it was right around the 4th of July that the barbecue thing was on.
And they'd be the same people we'd seen in New York earlier.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. I was invited to go to Greenwood this summer, to the same thing, but we're going to be in Cambridge at that point.
Yeah, well, we're not going to be there because our kids moved to Philadelphia.
Have a wonderful time. You won't get much barbecue in Cambridge, but.
Yeah.
There's probably some decent food by now. There wasn't when we were there. We could
some good food. The barbecue has a way to go, but
No, we could only.
In London, we did eat at Barbara Cow Adam Perry Lang was in charge.
Jamie Oliver owns a restaurant.
Yes, down by St. Paul's Cathedral.
Yes, yeah, Barbara Cow.
Which is really good.
Uh-huh. Now, I studied the menu in the window and put off by the prices, but.
The prices are right up there. Now, I understand the top table in Cambridge is called the Midsummer House.
Yes, it is. And
we were supposed to go there, but when we found out
we were going to go there on our anniversary, and then I looked at the menus. I'm cheap.
Are you sure you're not from the north of England?
Yeah, no. We went out to a very nice pub in a little village outside of town. Had a pub meal.
There you go. Well,
you're fun, John Shelton, right? Yeah, your book is very informational, as well as being witty and charming and indulgent. And thank you for talking to us.
Yes.
Well, thank you for letting me talk about my book. It was good talking with you.
Thanks so much. Travel safely and enjoy a visit to my alma mater.
I will. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this week's program, listening to it as much as we enjoyed producing it for you, and we'll hope you'll join us again same time, same place next week, and until then,
bye-bye.